Nah, I'm not into evil and torture and all that stuff. Plus, the Prince of Darkness should have sort of a distinguished look to him, and let's face facts, I'm no George Clooney.
You are listening to the Night and Day podcast, featuring the interview archives of Western New York music writer Tom Jennings. Tom has interviewed some of the biggest names in music and entertainment, and now you can enjoy these never-before-heard interviews. Here is your host, Tom Jennings.
Thank you for joining me for another episode of Night and Day. This week we have a doubleheader on tap with a couple of pretty amazing musicians. We have guitarist Steve Vai and drummer Terry Bozzio. And the tie that kind of binds them together is the fact that they both worked with Frank Zappa early on in their careers. And I think it was Zappa really that helped them both get their start. We'll talk with both of them about their time working with Frank Zappa. Terry spends a little bit more time talking about behind the scenes working with Frank Zappa and Frank's work habits, things like that. Very interesting stuff. Steve was coming to town as part of his 25th anniversary tour to support Passion and Warfare, his seminal album, an amazing album if you've never had the opportunity to hear it. As far as, you know, instrumental rock albums, it's right up there. Steve also went on to work with that great David Lee Roth band that featured Billy Sheehan, a Buffalo guy who's, you know, around where I live, Billy Sheehan is quite the legend. And Greg Bissonette, who's currently playing with the Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. And just an incredible three-piece. We talk a little bit about Steve and the band's attempts to get together for a reunion show that around this time, I think last year, it was shut down because there was too many people that showed up for it. We also talk about one of my favorite rock movies of all time, and that is Crossroads. Not to be confused with the Crossroads movie that starred Britney Spears. And even though my nephew Joey is a huge Britney fan, the earlier one starred Ralph Macchio. And it covers the legend of Robert Johnson and the deal that he made with the devil. And it's just a great, great, great movie. Vai plays the part of the instrumentalist for the devil. It's just a very cool scene. Very cool part for him. We talk about the kind of different connections and, you know, even the fact that Vai for a long time was looked at as an antichrist. But you'll hear that in the interview, so I don't want to spoil that. So let's get started. First interview is with legendary guitarist Steve Vai.
This is Tom Jennings of the Niagara Gazette.
Yes, I'm so sorry I missed your call. I don't know why my phone wasn't on read, but here I am.
All right. Well, no, well worth the wait. So a longtime fan, it's quite an honor to be able to speak with you today.
Thank you.
You're getting ready for the 25th anniversary of Passion and Warfare. I guess, you know, I'll throw a couple of softballs out at you because it's a piece for the show that's coming to North Tonawanda in the Buffalo area. Why this album? I mean, I know the timing obviously is 25th anniversary, but when did you decide that you were going to roll this thing out beginning to end?
Well, you know, it's my seminal recording as far as I think most of the fans and the press are concerned. And I always wanted to play it from the beginning to the end. And I love the idea of these anniversary kinds of things. And I thought, well, if there's ever going to be a better opportunity to have an excuse to play this record from beginning to end, this is it. So I embraced it, and here I am.
Yeah, and I mean, it really is an amazing album. And you know, I'm not just saying that because you're on the phone with me and everything, but in preparation for this tour, did you go back and listen to it again and just go, wow. it's really held up well.
Yeah, it's surprising. You know, it's hard because my perspective is that of the artist, you know. And, you know, I'm fortunate that I feel really good about all my records. But this one in particular, yeah. You know, when I recorded it, I didn't have any expectations because it was kind of different than what most people were classifying as instrumental guitar record, but I didn't think that way. I didn't even see it as an instrumental. I didn't see it as anything except, hey, this is what I want to do. So I didn't follow any particular format. And as a result, it was it has a sort of a quirky little place in the pantheons, I guess, of instrumental guitar records. And going back, and I didn't only have to go back and listen to it, I had to go back and learn how to play it. And that was, you know, when I got past the initial shock of it all, I realized that I was certainly a focused, intense, you know, determined young man when I made this record, and it was spilling my guts as bravely and almost chaotically as I could. And when you go back and you see that kind of freedom in yourself that you had, it's inspiring, you know. I'm fortunate in that I carried that through my career. You know, I always felt like, why do something unless you're going to be enjoying it?
Yeah, and I mean, I've read stories about how you fasted for 10 days when you recorded For the Love of God, and just the whole recording process went beyond what a typical recording process might be. I mean, is there any other stories that kind of come back to mind about that period when you were putting this thing all together?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. You know, whenever we go to create something, it's always kind of a reflection of what's going on with us at that time. And at that time, I was very into metaphysics and exploring all these crazy things, numerology, astrology, UFOs, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So that kind of was flowing into the music. And, you know, you look back, and it's like a little snapshot of who you were at that time, and this record is pretty much like that. What was the original question, though?
The original question was just maybe some of the sort of the quirkier things that went on, like the story, the legendary story that you fasted for 10 days.
Yeah, so because I was into all this metaphysical stuff, I was doing all of these things that people being basically prescribed in yoga books and meditation books and all that. I built this pyramid that was in there. It was just made out of wood and it hung from the ceiling, but it was pretty big. And it had the same dimensions as the Great Pyramid in Egypt. And I sat under it and recorded a lot of stuff. Wow. You know,
that's really all sorts intense.
Yeah, I never really told people that. I did back in the day, but it didn't stick like the fast thing did. What else did I do? I wasn't very superstitious or anything like that, but I was just intensely present as I was doing it. And that's about as spiritual as anybody can be, because that's when all the good stuff flows. So I didn't realize it at the time, but the thing that I was doing that had the most impact on the effectiveness of the music was I was completely focused on the music and following my impulses as they arose in the moment in creating whatever they fancied, so to speak. That makes sense?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's evident in the record. I mean, there is that sort of, I mean, I hear those Zappa influences with the you know, the spoken parts and all that other stuff. But from I don't know, I hate to use the term controlled chaos because it's really not a chaotic record. And there's moments that it's just so locked in. It's amazing. But yeah, I mean, it really is just more of a musical painting than, I guess that's the way I would describe it as a listener.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, it was. I think that was a result of. It's a very powerful tool when you don't have expectations. You know what I mean? When you're just doing something that just feels artistic to you, and there's no limits really. Your imagination is your only limitation. So, I wasn't trying to fit in to a particular mold or perspective. And that was very freeing. So I think that flowed into the music, and that's why it can be listened to today, and it really doesn't sound so, there's dated elements to it, you know, because it was in the 80s, and I did come from being in these 80s rock bands, and there's certain aspects of it that have a quasi-datedness to them, but really not that many. I mean, it doesn't fit into a format, and that I just did unconsciously.
And it almost seems weird in the sense that you were just coming off of spending time with the kind of, you know, I mean, David Lee Roth and that just rock band, and in many ways was very formulaic, but yet it wasn't. You know, I mean, Roth is known for being a showman and everything, but man, I mean, that band that he put together was just incredible. I mean, top to bottom.
Yeah, we kicked ass.
Yeah, and Billy Sheehan, you know, he's from out this area, Buffalo, and it's funny, I had a chance to interview him earlier this year because Winery Dogs were coming through, and he told me a little bit about that show that the three of you guys tried to get together in L.A., and it was shut down by the, mm-hmm. I believe it was the code enforcer or something.
Who's this, the local police, you know, whatever they call it, the people that come and shut down things.
I mean, I assume that the four of you were able to at least practice or rehearse together, even though you didn't get to play in public.
Well, we didn't, because we were only going to do two songs. And you don't really need to rehearse Shy Boy and Yankee Rose when you're Billy Sheehan and Steve Barr and Greg this and that. And Greg, Dave did want to run and listen to something, so he came over to my house beforehand, and we listened to it, and I played along with it, and, you know, he kind of prepared himself. And the whole evening was very interesting. It was really a great feeling to be with the guys again, feel that band community that we had so long ago, 30 years ago. And it was almost like vibrato bar interrupt us or something, yeah. Because I was ready to, we were ready to just start. And they came and they told us that we couldn't play because it was just oversold.
Yeah, and I mean, I've had the chance to interview Greg and Billy and now you, and I mean, those two guys, just incredibly musicians, incredibly humble as well, you know, just like yourself. And yeah, I mean, that combination, it was pretty special. I wonder if there's ever going to be an opportunity for the three of you to play again, either with or without Dave.
Well, you never know. I would certainly enjoy that because you're absolutely correct. Greg Bisnet is a drummer's drummer. I mean, the guy is so solid and on target and aware, and he could play anything, you know. And Billy is from another planet, you know. His skills and his ear are it's just rare. It's just very rare. I mean, if I would go as far as to say that it's non-existent, really. There isn't anybody that remotely, that I know of, plays like Billy Sheehan, you know? And I've got my quirkiness and a little bit of, you know, bizarre bend in me. And when the three of us would get together and, you know, play, it was pretty powerful.
Yeah, and I mean, on paper, that could have been a real recipe for disaster because you're all such, you know, like you said, you're all very unique players. And for bands to really lock tight like that, I mean, it really was of that caliber. It's usually one or two of the guys that stand out and somebody's kind of in the background, but top to bottom, that was a pretty amazing unit.
Yeah, we were lucky. The stars aligned.
I don't want to get too far off topic. I kind of wanted to touch a little bit on a couple other things. You know, I was first introduced to you through Frank Zappa. I had a good friend who was really into Zappa, and we sort of found you that way. And a lot of people know you through Crossroads, and then other people through David Lee Roth Band. If we could start with maybe Crossroads, because that was, I think, a real, real important musical memory for me. What was, at the time that you took that part for the movie, did you see that as something that was going to help advance your career, or was it just something that you just took at the moment and said, hey, sounds like a good idea?
Well, obviously, when an opportunity comes to you, a part of you says, you know, what will this mean in the scheme of how I can continue working and how it might add to my cachet. Of course, that was there. But a bigger part of me says, I don't know what's going to happen with this film. It might end up on the shelf and nobody sees it. I can't really expect it to do anything. But what I can expect is for me to do my best and to enjoy the process. And that's what I did, really, you know, in the moment. Hold on one second.
Oh, yeah,
sorry.
No problem.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my next interview. So I can finish this question and maybe one more quick one.
Okay.
But what was I talking about?
Crossroads.
Yeah. So I just did my best and put my best foot forward. And I was shocked at the impact it did have, because film, you know, records are one thing, but film is another. All of a sudden, people recognize you. And to this day, people recognize me from that film. And it was a pretty big hit film, but not even a blockbuster or anything like that. So it really had quite a supportive impact.
Yeah, and I, you know, I realized it today when I was doing a little background research on you. You're born June 6th, 1960, so the 666 piece, was that, I mean, has anybody ever made that connection based on you playing, like, you know?
Oh, yeah, there's people that make all sorts of weird connections. There's this one very funny website that somebody put up on why Steve I is the Antichrist. You know, and one of the things they use is because I was born on 666, and when I, on 6666, I turned six. You know,
wow.
It's ridiculous. It's just numbers. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't mean anything. I don't know anything, though.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's all tongue-in-cheek, for sure.
Well, it's fear. It stems from people's fear, you know, and they do that with all sorts of things that don't make any sense. And I just happen to be the target of a small group of fearful-minded people.
Yeah. Well, I know you've got your next interview to go. You know, thank you so much. I've had the blessing to see you as a solo performer, amazing, but twice with Experience Hendrix, and man, that was a heck of a tour, and you were quite a highlight to those shows, and that was quite.
Oh, thanks.
Well. And that G3.
Well, if you get to see the Passion Warfare, tour, it's the gist of me.
Yeah, Steve Karras is such a great guy as far as a publicist, and I'm sure Steve will be able to hook me up with some media passes, and we'll put a concert review on for you and everything. So I think Steve probably took care of me the last time he came through, because I saw you at the Watership Music Hall in Rochester. I know you play a ton of places, so you probably don't necessarily remember that show. But yeah, but anyhow, I wish you the safest of travels, and I appreciate this time, and I look forward to seeing you in November.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Steve. Bye.
Well, that was Steve Vai. Hope you enjoyed that interview. And now let's change things up and we'll shift over to Terry Bozzio, the Missing Persons album, Spring Session M, one of my favorite albums of all time. The drum work on that and how they actually captured it as part of the recording is absolutely amazing. Missing Persons was never quite able to recapture that magic of Spring Session M, but it still stands as a great album. Just listened to it from beginning to end the other day, and every song stands up. It's great. But anyhow, enough of me. Let's go to Terry Bozzio.
Hello?
Hello, is this Tom?
Is this Terry?
Yeah, this is Terry.
I'm very excited to finally be able to chat with you. How you doing?
Yeah, me too, man. Sorry I couldn't get to you. I was just finishing up my other interview, and the guy wanted station ID, so I couldn't pick up.
Oh, it's no problem. Yeah, the last time, it was just one of those really weird occasions where I just was like, bam, bam. I don't normally try to schedule things too tight because I know stuff happens. I mean, it happens on my end, too, so...
Yeah.
But,
well, no problem, man. I'm glad to be able to speak to you today, and glad we were able to reschedule and all. So.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I mean, I've been a longtime fan, a huge fan of UK Missing Persons, and man, I grew up listening to just a ton of Zappa. So, you know, it's good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If we could start with Zappa, I know that, you know, you've probably been asked a million times because this year is that anniversary of the Beatles thing about that. So if we could start with Zapp in the sense that, if you could tell me what impact playing with Zappa had in your career, like what kind of a drummer were you before Zappa, and what kind of drummer were you after you stopped playing with him?
Wow. I think I was a pretty good, well-prepared, up-and-coming jazz fusion kind of drummer, but with rock roots. And then I had my commercial music degree. I was classically trained, knew how to read, was exposed to and playing classical gigs and studying classical music, you know, timpani and whatnot, with members of the San Francisco Symphony. So I kind of knew all the basics and was just ready and raring to go. I had played with some great jazz musicians like Eddie Henderson, Joe Henderson, Woody Shaw, who all were around San Francisco, and using me locally. I had done sessions. I had played with some local symphonies, and was in several different bands and different affiliations that were playing different styles of music almost every day. I had a steady gig at the Great American Music Hall, playing in a big band, sight reading charts and blowing free with some really good players. I had met and was very influenced by Mark Isham, the film score composer, who was a high school kind of college friend, and taught me quite a bit and helped develop my musical sensibilities that are to this day in good stead. And I got this audition not really knowing Frank's music. So when I 3 days before the audition, I bought Live at the Roxy and elsewhere, and it just blew my mind. I didn't sleep for 3 days, and I felt very lucky to have made the audition and got in the band. And from there, Frank Zappa, to cut to the chase, he took me as a unknown or kind of well-known local San Francisco drummer to having world fame and the kind of credibility you can only have from having played with Frank Zappa or Miles Davis or Weatherport or something, McLaughlin, some of these great musicians that unfortunately those gigs just don't exist anymore for young kids, and a lot of the training ground for it, like when you think of, say, Maynard Ferguson, which Greg Bissonette, my friend, came up in, a lot of those gigs don't exist, and I feel sorry for young drummers who have talent and who have above average kind of ambitions to play something more than a beat, a backbeat or something, and they have no place to go, so that could help them. And so that was like a windfall for me. From that, I met Eddie Jobson. I was asked to replace Bruford and Holdsworth in that band. I met Warren Cucurullo, who was a fan of Frank Zappa, and we formed Missing Persons later. I think Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, all kinds of people saw me play with Zappa, and then I ended up playing with Jeff, and David Bowie saw me play with Zappa and asked me to play with him, but I think I was trying to do a solo thing at the time. So it was just like Marine boot camp for a musician. He made me play things that I had that were way more difficult than anything I had faced in classical music in college, and he pulled things out of me and gave me this experience of what the road life is, how to survive on the road, how to not how to avoid the pitfalls that kill Hendrix and so many of these great musicians, how to have fun, how to for instance, I didn't know I could sing and play, and he had me playing in 5/4 and singing, wind up working in a gas station, and I realized that from my jazz listening development, because you're playing complicated stuff and you're listening to a complicated saxophone player as if you're playing it yourself, that ability was able to be translated into being able to sing and play at the same time, and probably into the ostinato thing, to be able to hold down a groove and solo against it. So it was a very, very rich experience, and nobody would know or care who the hell I am if it wasn't for Frank. And he's definitely the most, one of the heaviest, you know, people I've ever met. Just in terms of that impact, when you feel some presence that's just like, holy cow, you know, he's at the top of the list. Nicholas Leninsky, a great musicologist who Frank also knew, had a depth, I felt, as well. And Robbie Robertson had a whole different kind of depth that I felt upon meeting him. And there's been many that I've met that have that depth of soul to me. But Frank is probably the most, you know, multi-talented and intelligent and funny guy, you know, and gifted, and you know, he's a great guitarist. Any one of the seven things he was great at, you know, writer, band leader, rock star, guitarist, classical composer, businessman, he could have made a career out of and been very successful. And he had all seven. So that was Frank, man. And now, I mean, after him, yeah, I learned a lot, you know. I learned how to project to the guy a quarter of a mile away at the other end of an arena in the cheap seats. And, you know, he brought out all that crazy stuff I did, you know, with Titties and Beer and Punky's Whips and being that character, and playing the drums in that way, which the fashion was sort of heavy metal. So, you know, we went for that angle of it. And he really pulled a lot of great things out of me, and I had a lot of fun and really learned so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Titties and Beer. You mentioned a lot of things. I could go off on about 35 different tangents, but Titties and Beer, I mean, just such an iconic song, you know, and I didn't really think about it in the context of music at the time, but you're right. In many ways, Frank's music didn't fit in a particular era. It was just Frank's music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really drew from everything. He made fun of everything. He used everything, and he was constantly, he was like a sculpture, you know, with some wet clay. He was constantly tweaking it and making the nose a little this way or the ear a little more that way, you know, what have you. Every day was a rehearsal, every sound check, and every night we were playing new parts to arrangements in different tunes. It was just a constant development, and it was 24 hours a day, and you had no other life. And, you know, when you're young and you don't have, like, permanent relationships, sort of, you know, that lifestyle worked just great for me. I mean, I made $750 a week on the first tour. And then he put us on like a year retainer. So he said, you know, I figure we're on the year, on the road half the year, and we're off the road half the year. So I'm just going to pay you $400 a week, and that's what I got. And union scale for any recordings and stuff like that. And believe me, man, it wasn't about the money, you know. But you know, when you think of like a college scholarship or something, you know, I learned so much being around that guy. Just phenomenal.
You know, and this is a off the Zappa topic a bit, but you know, after that, you know, you transition at some point, you get into UK. One of the things that's always confused me about UK is that in reality, you had some incredible players and musically superior to Asia, but yet Asia kind of takes it and just sanitizes it and becomes commercial. Were you at all frustrated with that? I mean, and I like Asia, I do. But to me, when I listen to UK and I listen to Asia, it's obviously, I mean, UK is you. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
I mean, I don't have those feelings. I love John. I think he's a great bass player, great musician, and a great songwriter. And then his voice, I still don't think, has been recorded. Like, I've heard it live, and it's just, you know, goosebumps on the back of your neck. He can do things I don't know, just he's got a, you know, sonic personality that's really wonderful, and a history, you know, behind him with Crimson and all that stuff. So, you know, he's amazing. And Eddie is quite a genius, you know. He's a genius composer. I didn't really get him that well in Zappa, but when he, you know, we went back to England and we're playing a week at the Hammersmith Odeon or something, and Ed came by and played us the new UK tape. Here's my new band, Frank, after leaving you. And, you know, we were all impressed, Frank included. So I was really happy to get the call from them. And then, I was sort of a sideman in that band. It was Eddie and John were the direction, and they were really open to my ideas. And I was a little, I wasn't really a Yes or a ELP fan. So, you know, I didn't, you know, not that it's bad music, it's just not my taste. It's not something that moves me, you know. So, whereas, say, I don't know, Genesis, I really liked. I don't know why. So, and still continue to like Peter Gabriel. That just, you know, is more the direction I'd like to, would have liked to have gone. So, when we kind of had a falling out, and I decided I wanted to do Missing Persons. I wanted to do something more modern and trendy and new wave, but with good players. So that's how we left. It was really my desire to do my own thing, and Missing Persons was the next, you know, the next step in that direction. So when Asia formed and had the success, I just heard John's voice leaping out of the radio and felt, this is great, you know. I love the guy, and, you know, good for him, you know, he's making it. And, you know, I don't particularly listen to that style of, you know, I suppose now we would call it, what, progressive corporate rock or something?
I don't even know what you call it. It's like progressive pop, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, that was the game, and you got to play the game. You know, so Missing Persons was okay. Here's the game, and here's the parameters we want to work within. So how can we be as creative as possible in those parameters? And, you know, John's just a guy who this music flows out of. And, you know, that's from way back, you know, to something like Fallen Angel, King Crimson, which is gorgeous, to anything he's done with Asia or the latest things, is always just kind of John. That's his heart. And I feel he's a pretty authentic person, so I don't feel, you know, as much as, you know, like if you're talking about baseball teams, you know, you're behind the Giants instead of this team or something, you know. I don't feel that way. I just feel like it's just John's soul and his journey, and that's what he's doing. But, yeah, you know, UK didn't have that much commercial success, and I suppose that was a disappointment at the time, but, you know, not after. And we had a great reunion a couple years back, and that was fun to do, and the music really holds up, and, you know, it's unfortunate that whatever business or personality things between me and Eddie, we just can't seem to get on the same page with it, but... I am looking forward to the Brenda Brothers heavy metal bebop band this July in Europe. So that could turn out to be maybe one of the final, you know, collaborations that I've done in my past that could turn into something that every once in a while we could continue to do that and remain friends. Because Randy's, you know, a jazz guy, and Barry Finnerty's been a friend since I was 16, you know. Great guitarist from San Francisco, and, you know. And Neil Jason is a very funky bass player, and so, you know, I think there's some good potential there, and I'm always open for anything, you know, so as long as it's a kind of a fair deal that I feel I can relate to and give myself to 100%, because I can't do anything halfway, you know. I couldn't play for somebody I don't really feel their music, and even though the money might be gazillions, you know, if I don't feel that authenticity or some connection there, I just can't do it. You know, it's not about money for me. It's more about, you know, what's the right thing for me to do in a certain situation that, you know, uses what it is that comes from inside of me. So yeah, you know, I'll probably never be rich, but I'm happy.
Well, I had no idea that you and Eddie Jobson weren't communicating, but I don't know. I guess it's not worth.
Well, you know, the same thing, different day. You know, it's kind of a personality clash. You know, Eddie's, you know, band is UK, and there's just no room for anything else but what Eddie and John do. So, you know, John's happy because he, you know, he wrote all the lyrics and the melodies and stuff, and he feels that's his part in it. And, you know, I'm happy because I played the drums and I wrote the drum parts and, you know, and all. But when it comes to the business dealings, there's this control and lack of transparency that's just always gotten in the way with Eddie. So unfortunately, you know, if I feel I'm not being told the whole story or something like that, then I start to lose my faith and trust. And there's a part of me that has been taken advantage of so many times in my life, you know, in the music business, that I just can't do that anymore. And so I don't want to set myself up to be disappointed. So that's where we left it. So I think he's, you know, using other great drummers, some of the greatest drummers that are alive playing now, and, you know, going on, and he's either calling it UKZ or whatever. And more power to him, because he's a great musician, great composer, very creative guy, and I respect him musically a whole lot, in spite of our disagreements on certain business things. So, yeah.
Well, I know you touched on missing persons, and I mean, Spring Session M, one of the things that has always stood out about that album is how you captured the drums. I mean, they are so, I mean, as far as the drums in the mix of a studio recording, I don't know of any other where they are just so good and so in your face that you just can't ignore them, even more so than something like Rush, you know what I mean?
Well, let me tell you why, and I'll tell you another record where that same thing happens, Billy Cobham's Spectrum. Okay? You hear every freaking note, and that's because of my good friend and one of the best engineers that ever lived, Ken Scott, you know? He worked with Beck, he worked with Elton John, Supertramp, David Bowie, you know, the Beatles. He was a tape op for the Beatles, and just the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet, and he loves recording drums. We did that big, it's like a big sample thing of all the great drummers he's worked with David Bowie's drummer, Dixie Dregg's drummer, Rob Morgenstein, myself, I can't remember all the rest of the guys that are on there, but all these great drummers he's worked with, and we sampled, resampled and recreated some of the stuff off those records, and it's available, so, you know, composers who aren't drummers can have my old Missing Person sound if they wish. And then it was the Rototoms and his whole approach to music. He's such a perfectionist, and, you know, I learned so much being with him. That was really a great experience too. And you couldn't find a better person on the face of the earth. He's just one of those wonderful guys that is still one of my dear friends. I think he's living in Nashville now and plugging into that. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of Nashville under the Ken Scott sonic personality.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I listen to a lot of recordings, obviously, because I write about music and everything, but it strikes me how little attention is paid sometimes to just the drum sound. And I know I used to read, especially in the 80s, where, you know, your studio time sometimes would just be eaten up trying to mic the drums properly and get a decent sound. And, you know, when you have those moments, like you said, with Billy Cobham, with yourself and whoever, I mean, they really do stand out.
It's hard. Studio time's expensive, and drum miking is very complex, and it has to do with each individual, their equipment, and the room that you happen to be in, you know? Different engineers hear different things and want different sounds, and we were very lucky. I mean, Ken is one of these guys who's like a doctor with the greatest bedside manner. When he played with Tony Williams on, or recorded Tony Williams on that Stanley Clark album, I think it's called Born to Love or something to do with love, but at any rate, Tony Williams plays on there, and the sound is great. And Tony Williams, Ken said, you know, I need to take your front bass drum head off in order to put, you know, this RE20 Electro Voice, his classic bass drum mic, inside the bass drum and muffle it and get the sound that will record well. And Tony said, well, you can do that, but I won't be able to play it because I'm used to playing with two heads on my drums, and I just can't, you know, can't go there with this muffled you know, single-headed bass drum. So Ken figured out, okay, if I take the drum apart, take all the lugs off, and screw in some wires, I can suspend the mic inside, and then, you know, run the cable through the, you know, decouple the Canon connector and then solder it back up once it's inside the drum so the cable goes through the vent hole and put Tony's drum back together so he just loved the way it felt and was able to play. And, you know, he's done that with so many people. How can we make this work? You know, I was having trouble with one or two tracks with missing persons because... you know, my cymbals are kind of spread out, and I was doing these big kicks that are off the beat, and the bass drum was like a four-on-the-floor type bass drum, and I was pulling the time a little bit every time I'd reach over, you know, to play these offbeat cymbal crashes. So he said, why don't we do make a loop of the bass drum, and then you can just play the top part of the kit. And because I knew my drum parts so well, I did that, and that's how we recorded it, you know, to make it perfect, because, you know, you need to make commercial music have that perfect time. Another thing he did was when we made our first demo up at Frank's studio, Frank was generous enough to, he said, well, you can come in my studio, you know, and help me get the bugs out of it. And, you know, I trust Ken Scott. He's great. And once you, you know, make a little demo and stuff while I'm on tour. So we went up there. We start recording and everything. And, you know, we're playing to a click. And the tunes just don't lift the way Missing Persons and Natural Music wants to lift. But they've got to be perfect because it's the 80s and it's, you know, click track central. So Ken had a box built that was a programmable click. So things like Destination Unknown and Mental Hopscotch, Walking in L.A., were all recorded with this programmable click that when you went to the chorus, it sped up a BPM or two. And then when it came down, it maybe just went down one, and then it went up another two. So the tune was constantly moving forward and had this excitement to it that is built in Natural Music. If you listen to Tony Williams, you know, like... he's playing the head at a certain tempo, and then, you know, the head ends and Miles is going to take a solo, and it just rushes forward, and it's so exciting. And I came from that school, you know, so when you have to be saddled with a click, it's kind of like no fun, you know. It's like walking with tar on your foot or something. So at any rate, Ken would work around these problems technically to make what we wanted happen, and he was just such a great guy at doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, the end product was, you know, amazing. It's one of my favorite. I'm Walking in L.A. I mean, they're all great songs. Words, Destination Unknown. It really does hold up very well.
Thanks.
And just a final question, because I've taken a lot of your time and I really appreciate it. You're coming to Buffalo, a little place called Nietzsche's and everything. This is a solo show. Can you just tell me kind of what this you said you're doing the Brecker Brothers thing and whatnot, but what are your solo shows like? What do fans, what can they expect in this for the show?
Well, it's going to be, anybody who's seen me play will know, you know, that it's kind of what it is I do. Those who haven't seen me play are in for a big surprise. I have a huge drum set. It's all tuned pitch perfect, and it doubles MIDI notes that reinforce the melody. So you hear real notes. I have eight different bass drums tuned to the eight different pitches, so I can go from an A to an E to a G, what have you, and make bass note changes. I accompany myself with either musical or rhythmic ostinato patterns, and then solo against that. So it's almost like a piano player playing a bass line with his left hand and soloing against it with his right hand. Then I've got my artwork. I've made a stage set out of four of my paintings, and I'll be bringing that to create some atmosphere. And it will be an evening of music on the drums, which runs from some things may be a little bit like modern classical music. Some things may be ambient and spacey. There's a lot of different colors orchestrationally between all the percussion instruments I have on my kit and the way I use space. And then, you know, I have quite a few pieces that I play, and every night, you know, I play whatever the piece is, the composition as is, and it always has improvisation in it. So, you know, a certain tune may have a certain groove, an ostinato pattern. Let's say it's an ethnic pattern from Africa, and then there's a theme at the beginning, and then there's some improvisation and musical development, and then it may return to that theme. So it's, you know, like songs, real music, but played on the drums. It's pretty unique. And my drum set, I would say, you know, with the Guinness Book of World Record crap aside, is the largest tuned percussion and drum set in the world that's practical and being used by a well-known drummer. You know, like most of the guys in the Guinness Book of World Records are just kind of collectors and assemblers in order to get their name in that book. I'm really not about that, and I call my drum set, I refer to it as the circus act, you know, because it's kind of hard to get past the size of it and the sculptural aspect. It's really a beautiful piece of sculpture as well, and but it's my instrument, and I need, you know, if you're going to play melodies, you need notes. So if you have a cymbal that has an interesting sound, I need eight of those in order to, you know, play melodies on that sound. And if I have tom-toms, I need whatever, 20 or something to, you know, to have enough notes to play the melodies I want to hear. And to keep the variation, you know. I could play on a three-piece kit, but then you'd hear the same notes in the same intervals all night long, and that wouldn't work. So I have very varied and contrasting types of tunes that I play, and some special surprises, and you know, most people will just go on the time traveler trip with me. I think from my father I inherited this ability to go inside and take people on a trip with me, and I don't always know where it's going to go, and that's a good thing, because it's usually better than something I might force with my will. So I just, you know, I've prepared myself with compositional techniques and knowledge of improvising in a compositional manner. And I've done my homework with, you know, permutations and rhythms and coordination. And I go out there and I see what develops out of, you know, using everything I know in the moment. And some people say it's spiritual. Some people get the mood and see, you know, film scores, or, you know, they think it's like a film score to a movie in their head, and you know, I'm grateful that they feel that way. That's kind of how I feel. You know, a two-hour show can go by like that and just go, wow, it's over, you know. Yeah. And doesn't feel like it was 2 hours. So yeah, but it is definitely not a bombastic Gene Krupa-like drum solo all night. It's moods and colors and scene changes and, you know, loud and soft and fast and slow and high pitch and low pitch and this sound and that sound and all the variations of real music are there. So that's what they can expect. And, God, man, I love Buffalo, man. You know, I love all those freaking north, you know, northeastern towns that have become the Rust Belt. You know, it's like, yeah, such beautiful old infrastructures up there, and the people have always been great. And I hope you all come out. And there's a great, you know, kind of artistic tradition up there too. So I hope you guys will all come out and enjoy the show.
Yeah, you're not far from the place you're playing. Is not far from the Albright Knox Gallery, our main, like, art gallery that's got some, it's got some incredible stuff.
I saw a special on that. It was wonderful. Yeah,
it's a great place. My son goes to college right across the street, and he's a drummer, so you know, this will be a great evening for him as well. So we're really looking. Nietzsche's is kind of a, I don't know, man, it's a cool little room. I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the best way I can describe it. It's got a lot of character. It's not one of those, yes, you know, brand new things that just has no character, and even, you know, they throw stuff on the walls to try to give it character. I mean, it legitimately just has character. It's just kind of a cool place,
you know,
to,
man,
see a show.
As long as it's got enough space for me to set up, which I'm sure it does, I'll play anywhere, you know. My setup now includes a Line 6 mixer and, you know, this MIDI reinforcement and line six speakers. So I'll have my own sound on stage everywhere I go. And they can, you know, they have the choice of miking everything and, you know, putting that out through the PA system or including my on-stage mix. But I've got it sounding pretty good in my little office at Drum Workshop there. And, you know, I think no matter where I play now, it's going to be real consistent. I had maybe a couple of bad nights in Europe out of a whole, you know, 20-day tour. That were just clubs where, you know, they were so small and we were on a budget and, you know, rather than lose so many hundreds of dollars a day, you take a gig that's low paying and they, instead of being 50 people seated, it's 100 people standing and they're right up against your bass drums, almost muffling it, just sucking all the sound out of the room. I had two of those experiences in Europe and that's the only time I ever had. You know, bad nights in terms of it being hard for me. Everybody loves it. You know, that's always the case. I'm so grateful to report. But, you know, for me personally, it makes it very difficult to hear, you know, the sound of the drums in the room coming back at you. And I can, you know, synthesize that now, you know, with this mixer. So great. It's digital, it's programmable. You can, you know, like if my bass drum is tuned to an E and maybe in that room you just don't hear that frequency, you hear some other frequency and it makes the drum sound out of tune, I can just EQ the frequency of that particular low E and goose it, and then you get the note that you want. And I've done that and it's pretty much tuned the same way every day and stays pretty much in tune. So it should be a good tour. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, a lot of dates. I mean, you know, it's pretty amazing. You're doing, it seems like you're doing a ton of traveling and a lot of days off.
You know, man, this year is the 50th anniversary of my first drum lesson. July 15th, 50 years ago, is my first drum lesson. I got a practice pad and sticks and a couple of books. And never looked back, you know. So I realize at 63 now, you know, I'm in good shape, and I want to play the drums and have that kind of experience and fun and share it with others as much as I can before I die. You know, I don't really care about money as long as I can survive and play and do what you love to do. That's kind of the reward in and of itself. So, you know, I just want to play before my body says, Terry, you know, your knee or your back or your wrist or whatever won't let you do this anymore. So, and I mean, you know, Casals was playing cello at the age of 90 and was, you know, probably better than he ever was. So I hope in music I can, you know, do something like that.
Yeah, Ringo's still doing it, and you know, funny because I just interviewed Greg Bissonette for the second time. I know you mentioned him earlier, but yeah, Ringo at 72 is just a freak of nature. I mean, he doesn't do the whole night, but man, he still plays.
Yeah, Ringo's a great. Well, you know, that's why I went and got my first drum lesson. I saw Ringo on freaking Ed Sullivan's show, and you know, yeah, it was, you know. I mean, the Beatles were an amazing phenomenon of our time, and can continue to be. I have a friend, a real close friend of mine, Tim, who lives in my little town of Camarillo, California, is a huge Beatles freak, and he's constantly playing that stuff, and they're re-releasing things that I forgot, and you just go, oh my God, I forgot they did this song, and oh man, that one, you know, and listen, this is like a classic country tune that they wrote back in the 60s or whatever, and oh, listen to the changes on this, and listen to the mood, you know, of this tune. They're, you know, really great, great group.
Yeah, in six years they put out that, you know, and in 6 years they put out more stuff than bands will do in 40. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other amazing thing about it all. You know, just I don't know. You know,
Music, life. We could talk about that for forever, for sure. But hey, man.
Yeah.
But you know, what a great honor. Thank you so much. I'm glad this all worked out. And said, I'll really look forward to seeing you when you come out here and when the piece goes up. Yeah, it'll be a little closer to the. It'll be a little closer to the date, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of it and all that kind of good stuff.
Great, great, great. And please come by and say hi, and yeah, I look forward to coming up there.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Terry.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for taking the time. All right,
Bye-bye. Thank you.
All right, I'll just wrap up by saying thank you for listening to Night and Day. This was a particularly long episode, so if you made it to the end, I really appreciate it. And if you have the opportunity to post a review of this podcast on any of the podcast platforms, Stitcher, iTunes, or however you're listening to it, I would certainly appreciate it. We'll keep the episodes coming as long as you keep listening. And this is Tom Jennings saying, I'll see you at your next concert. Thanks so much.